Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Inflation slowed for the sixth consecutive month in December, and that's good news for consumers and businesses, but concern about the chance of a recession continues. We're talking about the economy today, what matters, and later on how Ohio fits into the equation. Washington Post reporter Rachel Siegel covers the Federal Reserve and the domestic economy. Rachel Siegel, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So inflation slowed last month for the sixth consecutive month. That, I guess, is more key. What is the expectation that this slowing will continue?
Well, it is easier to answer that question the further along this trend we go. So the first month that there was a slowdown, there was a hesitation to say, oh, maybe inflation is moving in the right direction. Once you get to a 6 month, the hope is that things will continue. And it's easier to have some confidence in that if you look under the hood of what is still driving inflation today. The hope is that as supply chains continue to ease up, as there is a bit more of a rebalancing between the things that consumers are spending their money on and the supply out there in the economy, that things will continue moving in this direction. Of course, inflation is still way too high. This is not to say that the Federal Reserve or the economy is anywhere near where it needs to be, but you have to start moving in this direction in order to get there.
Right. So why how they're going to expect it to come back with another rate hike in a couple weeks, right? What's the, is this more art than science, or what informs them in the number of rate hikes and in the amount of the hikes?
Well, policymakers have been very clear for years now that they have no playbook for anything like what we've had since the pandemic began. They've moved through a few different iterations of flying without a playbook, and now they've had to not only respond to what is happening in the economy in real time, but make decisions that are going to bear on the economy in the future. So as they're debating how many rate hikes to issue, the scale of each of those rate hikes, they have to think about not just what it would mean on the very day that they announce the rate hike, but what it would look like 8, 10, 12 months down the line when that rate hike fully goes through the economy. There's no playbook for that either, and officials have been very upfront about that. They say that they are guided by the best data they have at that moment, but that there is plenty of uncertainty about how those decisions will actually play out.
We're talking about the economy today. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and my guest is Rachel Siegel. She's an economics reporter for the Washington Post, and she covers the Federal Reserve. If you have a question or comment this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to talk about what you said when you said you got to think about what's still driving inflation. Different things drive inflation at different times, right? This partly it's the infusion that was made into the economy because of the pandemic, and you said the supply chain issues.
Mm-hmm. Both of those things, and those things have played different roles at different times. So we mainly talk about the American Rescue Plan at the beginning of President Biden's presidency for infusing a lot of extra demand into the economy. It was at a time when it was very unclear when vaccines would roll out, when the labor market would fully recover. So people got expanded unemployment benefits. They got stimulus checks, which in many cases helped people survive and scrape through at a time that was still extremely painful for families and businesses and for the overall economy. But then what followed was a quicker return to some degree of normalcy. People got vaccinated faster. The labor market started recovering faster. So at the same time that you had all of this momentum going on to the economy that was much faster than expected, supply chains were not able to keep up. Well, why do you need supply chains? You need supply chains to help get products off of boats as they pull into the port of Los Angeles. You need trucks to be able to keep going all over the country. You need factories to be able to make new cars and chips and treadmills and at-home office supplies. And that system, again, was just confronted with this totally unprecedented challenge and could not keep up. So what you've seen in the past almost 2 years that inflation has been on the up, you've seen those dynamics play through into used cars becoming very expensive, airfare becoming very expensive, lumber, things that, you know, are a reflection of what people are spending their money on and needing to pay a lot more in order to do it.
Right. And so when they're tailoring or talking about these rate hikes, they've got to think about how that affects and how they want to change how people are spending their money.
Exactly. And part of the problem with the way rate hikes work is that they can only target the demand side of what's happening in the economy. So if you think about a classic econ 101 model, you've got supply going in one direction, demand going in another. The Federal Reserve can't do anything to fix supply chains. It can't help those things get off boats. It can't help, truckers come back into the labor force. So all it can do is try to suppress this consumer demand or business demand. It would, make it more expensive to borrow money to get a house or to get a car, or for a business to invest to open up a second location or hire more people. But there might ultimately be a limit to how that solves the problems that the economy is facing today.
A lot of people, when they're talking about inflation these days, are talking about the price of eggs, which sounds sort of proverbial in its way, but that's really not, I mean, the egg issue is separate from all of this, right?
The egg issue is separate and another example of what the Federal Reserve cannot do. So on the one hand, eggs are, a classic example of what people spend their money on, how they think about budgeting, sort of like gas prices. But this huge surge in egg prices, not to diminish it, but it's been caused by a massive outbreak in avian flu. And that is something that could happen totally, separate from what's happening with the COVID economy. The Federal Reserve can't do anything about it, but of course it can't just, that can't be its answer either. It has to think about all of these things that play into the economy and figure out what tools it has to try and make sense of what's happening right now.
So the white collar layoffs, especially in the tech sector, are also getting a lot of attention. Tens of thousands of layoffs announced in the last couple months. Most of us worry when we hear about job losses, but most of these folks are skilled and they're in demand somewhere. These are not people at the bottom of the food chain.
That's the hope. So
Okay.
the main thing that the Federal Reserve does, or one of the things that can be a consequence of higher interest rates, is a slowing job market. And the fear is that the job market slows so much that you have a steep spike in unemployment, a very painful recession that is felt by people losing their jobs. And I don't say this to, I'm sure this isn't comfort to anyone who has felt these tech sector layoffs, but that's not exactly what we're seeing right now. We're seeing companies in the tech industry, the housing industry, some media companies that perhaps in some cases sort of bulged a bit during the pandemic, that had this kind of artificial bump when the economy was so out of whack, and now are peeling back or having to scale back for fear of an economic slowdown. And the hope, as you mentioned, is that those people will be able to find new jobs. There are still way more job openings out there in the economy than there are people looking for work. The unemployment rate is still very low. It is not jumping yet. So the hope, again, is that those kinds of layoffs will be contained to parts of the economy that are still trying to find this new normal versus becoming much more widespread and tipping into a recession.
I'm wondering about other effects of the pandemic and how we might recover from all of this, or adjust, maybe is the better word, because of the way we now work from home. Not me, but a lot of other people work from home now, and it's becoming sort of expected that that's an option. So I guess you think about people not moving like they might have moved when they got a new job after a recession or something like that, right?
Yeah, and the Federal Reserve is very upfront about this too. They say that part of the challenge in setting policy right now is that they don't exactly know what the economy is going to look like on the other side of this. It's sort of like trying to sketch out a journey to a destination where you don't really know where that is. But sure, people are, there are many jobs where they're able to now work from home. There are other people who moved and bought a house in an area that suddenly saw huge housing inflation because they were able to work remotely. Or people are reconsidering whether they want to work full time at all if they have that kind of cushion. Of course, on the other end of the economy, you have people who never had that choice, who have had to continue working in person, who are weighing the risks of being exposed to COVID, wondering how that, bears on their childcare if they get sick. These are all things that all of us are figuring out to some extent. And of course, if you are a policymaker trying to figure out what that means for the overall economy, you're really having to try and make sense of that in real time.
I mentioned that the Federal Reserve is meeting next week to raise interest rates again. Is there any idea what the increase might look like at this point?
So, without a sure guarantee, it seems like, based on comments that officials have made over the last couple of weeks, that they are comfortable slowing down yet again to a quarter point increase when they meet next week on Tuesday and Wednesday. of course, we'll have to wait and see, you know, what the final answer is. Mm-hmm. But it seems that based on the inflation data that we've gotten in recent weeks and this overall sense that it is time for the Fed to start slowing down and wait to see how its rate hikes move through the economy, there seems to be momentum towards slowing down from their recent increase, which was a half a point, to a quarter of a percentage point next week.
Where does that quarter point, if they approve it, where does that get us total?
Yeah, so it gets them, you know, into what they call restrictive territory, which would be high enough to actually slow the economy. They're approaching 5%. The expectation based on the projections that we've gotten from the Federal Reserve in the past is that they expect to go past that. So the thinking is that there will be another rate hike next week, and then maybe two or three more before they pause altogether, keep rates high, and then see what happens with the economy with rates high enough to really slow the economy.
In your article on Sunday, you said that 2023 is not the norm as the Fed makes this all-out effort to regain control of inflation. Is it because of all the stuff we've just been talking about?
It's because of all the stuff that we've just been talking about, and because when I was thinking about how to write about this quarter point rate hike, right now it sends a signal of the Fed is slowing down. They are moving back from these just whopping increases, one after the other that we saw last year when they were racing to catch up with inflation. But actually, historically, a quarter point hike is how the Fed prefers to move. They prefer to move very gradually, very slowly, with a little tweak up, a little tweak down. And when I realized that, I felt like that was some way to capture just how unusual things are now, that, you know, a quarter point hike is seen as, okay, they're slowing down, they're about to stop, when in normal times, that's just sort of business as usual.
What is your sense? I know you cover the Fed and not the consumer end of it, but what do we know about how consumers are feeling about the economy as inflation sort of slows down, but it's slowing down differently?
It's slowing down differently. Everyone has a bit of a different experience with inflation. Everyone's basket of goods is different if you spend more money on rent versus more money on gas versus more money on groceries. But there is this interesting paradox in the economy that I found talking to economists and businesses and families, where it sometimes feels like there is an overall sense of foreboding, of concern. There's this sort of expectation that maybe the economy is slowing down, that, you know, a recession could be around the corner, inflation is really high, but that doesn't necessarily translate into different behavior. So people still spend, they might still go on vacation or go out to a restaurant. I'll talk to businesses who say, yeah, you know, I'll talk to other business owners I know, and they're really worried, but I'm doing okay. And so there seems to be a bit of a disconnect between how people perceive the economy out there versus their own situation.
Is a recession, quote unquote, inevitable when you're coming off inflation like this?
History would say yes. It's very difficult to have such high rate increases, one after the other, that have the intended effect of slashing extremely high inflation without slowing the economy so much that you get a recession. But again, there's this other version of how strange things are right now, which is that a recession means a lot of different things. It can mean a very technical slowdown in the economy, or it can mean something that is probably more top of mind in all of our memories, which is what happened in 2008, which happened after COVID. That might not be what we get. It seems like there is a growing expectation that even if there is a technical slowdown to quantify as a recession, that it could be mild. It would be a small increase in the unemployment rate. Inflation would come down. Of course, we don't know yet if the Federal Reserve will be able to pull that off, but that's what they're aiming for.
This job growth, again, this is not necessarily, or I should say the job growth that we experienced was not related to inflation. It was related to the pandemic.
It was related to the pandemic and a huge, I just tend to think about so many parts of the economy that were just sort of out of whack. They got this huge whack during the pandemic, and the labor market was one of them, where you had millions of people lose their job overnight. And then as the economy was really just ricocheting back, all of a sudden businesses were really eager to hire. And they were eager to hire at a much faster pace than people were coming back into the labor market. So part of the reason that the economy has continued to grow, that the labor market has continued to grow, is that businesses are still really eager and desperate to hire. You'll talk to restaurant operators that are scouring for bartenders and waiters, truck driving companies that are eager for truckers. People are not entering the labor market at the same rate. And that's a whole separate bucket of questions as to why that is. But this momentum that the labor market has had is because there's still a lot of openings and a lot of employers looking to fill them.
And so it's also really super exciting that we're going into another bitter argument about the debt ceiling in the House of Representatives, right? Can you talk about the debt ceiling and how that plays into all of this? Because it's all happening at the same time.
It's all happening at the same time. And I mainly cover the Federal Reserve, which has this strange independence from Capitol Hill and from politics that is definitely not the case when we're talking about the debt ceiling, which essentially comes down to whether or not the government is going to be able to pay its bills. And we are now into this window where the Treasury Secretary has warned that things could get bad pretty quickly. It doesn't seem like we'll hit a complete disaster zone until sometime this summer, but the closer we get to not being able to broker a deal between the House and the Biden administration, the more real those threats become, where it would be quite bad very quickly if the government suddenly couldn't pay its bills.
Let's see, Susan in Nebraska, you're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi. My question is, we haven't had inflation for like 40 years, since the 80s. And where would we be now if inflation had been at a more normal rate of, say, 3% a year? Where would our prices be? Is this just playing catch up on the inflation that didn't happen all those years? Partly, I got to say, because workers were being screwed out of fair wages. But, where would we be now? So that's my question.
All right. Thanks, Susan.
Well, thank you, Susan, for that question. And it's a fascinating economic debate over what this normal rate of inflation should be. Should it be 2%? Should it be 3%? Should it be 4%? And I don't know that answer, and I don't know if anyone does, but I think that the difficulty in figuring out where we would be if things had been different in that 40-year period that you mentioned is that shocks happen to the economy, that something like a pandemic or a war in Ukraine or things that unfortunately are probably to come that we don't know about yet can just level this huge wave of uncertainty on an economy that might otherwise be trending in the right direction. So you're right. If wages were different, or if home prices were different, or if rates had been higher for longer, we might be in some other version of normal that we don't even know about. But unfortunately, maybe that wouldn't even have been enough to put off the hazards and the risks that would come with a shock like a pandemic that no one saw coming.
I know I have to let you go, but I was just wondering what your thoughts are about and what they're talking about when it comes to wages, because that seems like something that was so out of whack when the labor market started getting messed up and you just realized how little people made and how many people were working multiple jobs in this, particularly in the service industry, just to make ends meet. And that was completely out of whack with what it costs to live in this country.
Completely out of whack. And this sort of added reflection of what was asked and required of, service sector workers, in-person workers, essential, quote unquote, essential workers during the pandemic, who were often the ones exposing themselves to the most risk for the least pay, while others were able to, stay at home or remove themselves from that risk. Of course, many of those workers are not being paid wages that are able to catch up with inflation at the same time that rent is going up, that food is going up. That gets to what we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. about how we have this top line number for inflation, but that does not reflect everyone's experience equally.
Rachel Siegel, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Siegel is an economics reporter for The Washington Post. We've been talking about the Fed. It's supposed to raise rates maybe 0.25% in the next week. We're talking about the economy writ large, and also we'll be drilling down into the Ohio place in that economy later on in the program. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Inflation and layoffs in the tech sector are two factors that suggest a recession could be ahead, but there are countervailing factors tempering that concern. We're looking at the current state of the economy. Brian O'Rourke is a professor of economics at Robert Morris University in Pennsylvania. Brian O'Rourke, welcome.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be with you.
Do you think we're headed for a recession?
If you would have asked me this a month ago, I'd have said without a doubt. But looking back at the data that has recently come out and looking at the forecast for the GDP that's supposed to be released on Thursday, I'm starting to temper that significantly. And part of the issue with asking that question is how we define recessions. We should have had a recession declared last year. If you go by the traditional standard definition that when you have two consecutive quarters of declining GDP growth, we had that last year, first and second quarter of 2022, but no recession was declared. If you look back at the recession that that was declared for the during the pandemic, you see that there were technically two quarters of negative GDP growth there, but really that intense decline in GDP only happened over about 2 months. So the declaration of recessions has really changed in a weird way. I think your previous guest mentioned how things are so out of whack, and part of the out of whackedness in our economy is affecting how we declare these things.
It's interesting. I mean, you think we can just go on and get back to normal, but the pandemic kind of changed everything. I mean, do you see a new normal ahead?
Do I see a new normal? I think certainly you see this in the labor market, as so many people are expecting to be able to work from home. I mean, that's clearly a new normal, and that opens up a lot of opportunities for folks who can't afford to live in, say, San Francisco or New York, but can make a killing in places like Western Pennsylvania, where they, you know, if they're paid even close to on par with what they would get in those metropolises, but they are able to live somewhere else, you know, that could be a new normal. I've had some interesting conversations with other economists about what is a recession anymore, and I mean this time is so peculiar, because usually we think of recessions as declining GDP and increasing unemployment. But we have seen declining GDP and unemployment is at historic lows. If that's a new normal, then a lot of the models that we use in economics are going to have to be chucked out the window. That'll be a lot of job security for us going forward. Or we all get fired because we don't know what we're doing.
I'm just wondering about, like, the last time there was a pandemic in 1918. The systems that we take for granted today, whether it's computerization or the logistical, you know, the supply chain logistics that we are so familiar with now, didn't exist back then. So we can't, there's not even a back, you can't go back in history, really. There's no comparable.
No, there's not. This is an incredibly unique time period. I mean, obviously we have had pandemics. We've had recessions, we've had high inflation, but this is so weird. It's, you know, the high inflation with the low unemployment. It's something that, you know, one of the reasons that policymakers have had such a hard time addressing this is because there's no textbook example of what you're supposed to do here. Again, we talk about how economists try to model the economy and how we try to understand the way all these moving parts at the macroeconomic level. So that's the big picture level. How do those all fit together? Sometimes we think we know what's going on and things work as they're supposed to. So I'm thinking at during recessions, say in the early 90s, or even after 9/11, the policies that were put in place kept those recessions very, very mild. In fact, the early 90s recession is one of those recessions that is so mild that people only knew we were in one when you look back later at the data. The COVID recession was one of those recessions that's that you look at, you know it's coming, you know when you're in it, you know it's going to happen, and no one is surprised when when all of these forces come together, where unemployment spikes, GDP drops like a rock, and then you're out of it. And that's the surprising part, was how short it was. If you look back at recessions over the last 100 years, this is going to be one of the shortest ones ever. And at the beginning of the pandemic, you would have thought, oh my gosh, we're heading to a Great Depression, just because of all of the confluence of events. And then you throw in the war in Ukraine on top of all that, and you know, it should have been utter chaos. And I think we've gotten off rather easy.
And also the war in Ukraine, and then there is also all the other factors that the Fed can't control, which is the weather, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So you've got, you know, whether it's warmer than expected winters here, or all the snow that they're getting in California, or the rain that they're getting in California, depending on what part of the state you're in. Your previous guest nailed it. She was answering the question from the caller, and she mentioned the idea of shocks. It's just, if there were no shocks, all of this economic stuff would be really, really easy. And all the policy stuff would be really, really easy. But, you know, if we had no shocks, life would be pretty boring.
I'm thinking about, too, another huge factor that I'm wondering how economists are quantifying it, because we talk about consumer behavior a lot. We don't talk about worker behavior as much. There's sort of the implication, or it's expectation, that a worker loses their job, they go out and they get another one. Well, that wasn't possible during the shutdown. And I'm just wondering you're asking about the long-term implications of that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, exactly. You said it exactly right. You expect someone, they lose their job, and, well, you know, tomorrow I got my resume out there and I'm looking for something else. And when there isn't an option, what are you going to do? I mean, well, your economy, you know, drops, you know, your GDP goes down to, you know, however many, 10, 12, 15% or whatever it went down. But one of the things that again, sort of the coinciding of all of these events, you see that people start leaving the workforce. And because of the way we measure unemployment, if people leave the workforce, unemployment's going to go down. So, you know, I'm looking at data as, you know, here comes COVID, GDP drops, it's like walking off a cliff, and unemployment shoots up. So it's the mirror image of the cliff you've fallen off of for GDP. There's another labor statistic called the labor force participation rate, and that measures what percentage of the population is actually involved in the workforce. And if you look at that carefully, you also see that number drops. It drops very, very sharply, and it comes back a little bit, but it hasn't come back. You know, we have still far fewer people in the labor force now than we did before the pandemic. And I think part of that has to do with the baby boom generation, where some of them were working. Not all of them needed to be working. They like to work. They like the camaraderie. And when COVID happened, they're like, I don't need it. I don't need this. And they've left the workforce, and some of them have come back in, but a lot of them haven't.
The intersection of a huge, the baby boomer generation was already retiring in droves. And,
right. And yeah. this pushed a whole bunch more of them out of the workforce permanently, I think. And so you see all these, you know, all these signs for, hey, we need workers. And people are not able to fill those jobs. And perhaps fortunately that happened because wages started to climb up as a result. I mean, like my kids 2 summers ago made minimum wage, and then last summer made $12 an hour working, you know, at a low skill job. Part of the reason they got that increase in pay was because Dunkin' Donuts couldn't find any workers, and they're willing to hire my really inexperienced teenage daughters to work at $12 an hour. Unfortunately, of course, with inflation going up, then those wages don't keep pace.
Well, the whole wage thing was another huge shock. It became so crystal clear during the pandemic about how underpaid people were and expected to survive, making – I was just shocking. I mean, we knew it intellectually, but people working 2 and 3 jobs just to make ends meet.
Yeah, so
not sustainable, we learned.
No, the low-skilled jobs, you know, my kids are working entry-level jobs. I don't – they shouldn't get paid a lot. simply because they don't have skills that they're bringing to the market. They're developing those skills, which is great. But when you hear about people who are working in those essential jobs and really the unbelievably small amount of money they're making.
No benefits, nothing.
No, yeah. It's stunning that so many of them have stayed in those jobs over these last couple of years. It's a remarkable, we can commend them for doing that and thank them so much for staying in those positions. But financially, it's stunning that they weren't getting paid more. Then the question, eventually, and these questions build upon each other, but if you start paying those workers more, how does that affect the prices that we have to pay for the services that they provide? That's, we don't want these people to make such a small amount of money. We also don't want to pay higher prices for the services that they provide. So, it's a really difficult kind of balancing act between those two portions of the market.
There is we already talked a little bit about, the tens of thousands of layoffs in the tech sector. We focus a lot on the tech sector in this country. I suppose they do all over the world now. What is your expectations about when the impact of that will hit us? Or maybe not even ever notice it, like you were saying.
Yeah, that's a good question. When you start hearing that Amazon is going to lay off 10,000 workers, or Microsoft's going to lay off 10,000 workers, 10,000 is a lot of workers. And for those individuals, you think, oh my gosh, that's they probably have skill sets that can translate to other jobs. And so hopefully they'll be the kind of workers who lose their jobs and then they can go find something else. At the big picture level, those numbers aren't going to make much of a dent in the unemployment rate. They're just 10,000 just isn't enough. The question will be if that becomes even more widespread to other industries. Amazon can lay off 10,000 people because they're not delivering as many packages because people can go out and shop. If restaurants start laying off workers, then we need to panic. Panic is maybe a little bit too extreme, but we need to start worrying because they would be going from, man, we really need workers, we really need workers, to now we're laying people off. And the reason for that would be people aren't spending money anymore. So at the macro, at the big picture, each industry is, there's a little bit something different going on in each industry. In recession, some industries do really well and others don't do quite as well. And coming out of that enormous shock from the pandemic, some industries are going to have to readjust as we get back to some degree of normalcy.
One industry that has been affected a lot by a lot of things during this period has been the home building industry and the housing industry, which is already way behind since the recession. We have a huge housing shortage in this country. It's pretty much across the board. It's contributed in part, this housing boom we've been going through for people who live in those neighborhoods that are super hot. It's one thing, but if you're trying to find a place to live, it's another thing. And I'm wondering how they're ever going to catch up given this intersection of factors. The supply chain was not something, a figment of someone's imagination. It was a real thing.
Right. Yeah. So home builders had trouble getting inputs to build homes. And then when the Fed starts raising interest rates,
right.
So now you're crunching the consumer and you're crunching the producer. And you add on top of that, in a lot of municipalities, the regulations that are put in place as far as building affordable multi-unit houses, that's an industry that has so many forces working against it right now. Again, you start to wonder if the solution to that is more people work from home and more people move to Western Pennsylvania, because we got lots of space and we got lots of people who want to build houses over here.
Any thoughts about the time the Feds are going to be meeting in the next couple of weeks? They're expected to hike the rate another about 0.25 percentage point. Any big changes looming, recession struggles that we might have with that, or not necessarily?
Well, I think if it's a 0.25 point, I think that starts to encourage investment again. As the rates keep climbing, investment gets more expensive. If you squash investment, that's that's bad for long-term prospects. You need people investing today so that there are factories and you know, jobs for people to move into. So the slowdown of that of the interest rate hikes would be, I think, an encouragement to investment. The downside that the Fed doesn't want to see is people overreacting to that, so that they don't want too much investment happening, because that starts to put more pressure on supply chains. It starts to put more pressure on input prices, which drives up inflation again. So the you know, the Fed doesn't want to overshoot on the interest rates, because they are, you know, they are not entirely in favor of causing a recession. That's not their really right. their objective. But they would rather cause a recession than they would have to deal with perpetual inflation for the next couple of years. You do not want to be the person running the Fed who was overseeing things when inflation was at 6% and 7% and you couldn't get it to come down. They'll overshoot before they undershoot.
Brian O'Rourke, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
And it's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me. And good luck with the economy, everyone. It's a crazy place.
Super interesting. Brian O'Rourke, currently a professor of economics and the B.K. Simon Fellow at Robert Morris University. We're going to drill down into local issues, local economic issues, things we're grappling with in Central Ohio. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're looking at the current state of the economy, shifting focus to the state of Ohio and especially Central Ohio. Doug Buchanan is editor-in-chief of the Columbus Business First. Doug, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So Intel has kind of taken up most of the oxygen in the room over in recent months when it comes to Ohio's economy. Let's talk about that. I mean, what the real implications are for Central Ohio going forward. What do you think about?
Well, I mean, the implications are huge, both even just this year and then, you know, certainly longer term. But just this year, Intel needs to hire several thousand construction workers to start building this thing, this huge complex, while they're also hiring for the people who are actually going to staff it, and in many cases sending them to Arizona or Colorado or wherever to get training for it. But you know, the pressure that's putting on the construction industry immediately is going to be felt at a lot of different firms on a lot of different projects, just because, as you said, they're kind of sucking the air out of the room with that big announcement.
A lot of competition. I mean, they've done this before. This isn't their first rodeo. I'm wondering, have we learned? I mean, have you guys looked at what the impact has been with similar projects in different parts of the country?
Well, yeah, we sent a reporter out to Arizona to look at Chandler out there, which you know, is you know, wasn't as big as Columbus at the time, but you know, the effects on Chandler, Arizona, were profound. I mean, they their economy immediately kind of shifted into overdrive, and it hasn't really slowed because Intel continues to invest out there. You know, the Ohio announcement obviously is the big one, but they are expanding that plant out there, and so you just saw all manner of other businesses show up, and then people, just their population exploded. And so, you know, how they have been trying to keep up with that is instructional for us, and for particularly the people out in Northwest Columbus, or I'm sorry, Northeast Columbus, and how, you know, they're going to be prepared for that, both in terms of people and housing and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, the interest rates are going up and will be up for another couple years probably. Up relatively speaking. I mean, 5% probably looked really good about 30 years ago when I bought my first house, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I would have loved that. Yeah. But yeah. Now, you, when you're looking at maybe a baby boomers downsizing and that kind of thing, doesn't look so great, you know, when you're talking about downsizing. But be that as it may, the housing market is in, I'm trying to figure out even what you describe it as in Central Ohio and what's going to happen, because there's simply not enough places for people to live.
Yeah, I always say that anything that you talk about with the Intel impacts, they were here before right. Intel made this announcement. This has just focused everybody's attention, and it has really, really brought a laser focus to what we need to do. And housing, we were already well behind the pace. That's why we had these crazy price run-ups over the past 3, 4, 5 years. It's because we were behind the pace that we needed to be at, because Columbus is a growing community. It has been a growing community. It's just, you know, you tick those numbers up a couple of percentage points to add in all of what's coming with Intel. And so not only, even if we just maintained the pace of previous building, we'd still be falling further behind because of the increased demand. But as you said, interest rates now have really just cooled that entire industry off. And we're going to fall behind once more, you know, and you know, have to redouble our efforts in 2024.
I know that Worthington's thinking about a levy to raise money to build affordable housing. That could become a trend. There are lots of creative things people are out there trying to do, but it really involves government getting involved, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you see what Columbus is doing with the housing bonds that they've sold and raised all that money for, and that is because exactly what you say, the private marketplace, the costs are just out of whack, and so you cannot really build, especially affordable housing under these conditions. So communities throughout Central Ohio really need to consider whether they want to do the same thing, because even though the plant is out there in New Albany, you're absolutely right. The people are going to be moving to Worthington. People are going to be moving to Dublin and driving out there, and all of these have to take place. We talked with the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, and they're advocating or lobbying for some kind of a statewide housing fund to try to help help communities change their zoning laws and approve more projects. But it's anybody's guess whether any kind of funding will come about because of that.
We've been talking about fears of a recession, which would be completely logical coming off of this inflationary period. Nationwide aside for a moment, what does something like Intel coming into Central Ohio, does it inure us? Does it inoculate Central Ohio from the impacts of a recession?
I mean, longer term, yeah. It's still going to be a pretty painful rest of this year or into 2024 whenever the recession actually hits. It will have that immediate impact. But, one of your guests mentioned earlier that, you know, there's actually more job openings out there than there are unemployed people. So we already have this mismatch in the job market, and Intel helps bridge some of those gaps, but you still have to get the people wanting to work there. I think with Intel and all of its suppliers, and then Honda with that battery plant and all of its plants and all of its suppliers, like on the manufacturing side especially, we've got a lot of promising projects coming up, so that we should be able to protect and grow that particular industry. But those plants aren't coming online for another couple of years, so it's just an immediate period where we're still going to feel that pain. Good news for Ohio and Central Ohio is we've never grown as quickly as the United States and some of these other high growth cities, so we don't fall as much when this kind of thing happens. We don't have a Microsoft laying off 10,000 employees here. I mean, we have had some significant job cuts from some of our higher flying companies, but just nothing like that kind of scale.
What they're doing over down by Parsons and 71, that whole development area around Nationwide, which is, every time I drive by, it kind of blows my mind how big it's gotten.
Yeah.
And the fact that Nationwide, I guess finally in some people's minds, started really investing in the area so that people can live near where they work. Do you see Intel making substantial concrete investments in the region outside of these big chip factories?
Well, I mean, yes, but not in the kind of direct way that that is such a unique case, what Nationwide Children's is doing over on the South Side. But yes, I mean, and to bring this back to workforce specifically, like Intel is putting money into our economy now. They're, you know, they're setting up programs with local colleges, you know, to do that. I haven't heard anything on the housing side, but they certainly know. You mentioned, you know, this isn't the first time they've done this. So
yeah,
they know, you know, kind of a playbook for getting the workers that they need. And so they're going to do everything that they can on that end. And then, you know, the making Central Ohio attractive to people moving here, that's kind of our, you know, responsibility. And, you know, there's just a lot of things that we need to get, you know, to do if we're going to maintain that status.
You recently reported that venture capital investment in Central Ohio among Central Ohio companies fell dramatically in 2022. Pandemic related, waiting to see where the chips fall with all of this messing around we've been doing with the economy.
Yeah, I think it's waiting to see where the chips fall. I mean, the same thing I mentioned earlier about overall growth. I mean, VC growth, Ohio has been just going gangbusters with VC the last few years, but we're still 1% of the nationwide total. I mean, we're still getting crumbs compared to some of these other regions. So yes, last year I think it was $700 million in VC in Central Ohio, which is a great number, but the year before was $1.4 billion. If you want to look on the positive side, both of those are still the highest that we've ever seen. 2021 was the highest. 2022, even with that dramatic drop, still the second highest number on total. So we are still getting money flowing into Central Ohio for these companies because, you know, there's still growth opportunities with most of our tech companies.
I'm wondering how Ohio has fared compared to other states. We're still an old state.
Yeah.
We keep losing young people to other states. But overall, how's Ohio doing?
Well, you know, we're older and we're less healthy and we're less educated than, you know, probably the averages or a lot of other states. And that's just not a good combination for long-term growth. So, mentioning that sense of place that you want people to want to move to Ohio. And I think, one of the strategies that we're seeing now is trying to get people who maybe moved out when they were college students, but now they are getting married or starting to have children. And so now we see if maybe, they want to come back. So, I think that's where some of the marketing is going. We have a lot of college students in Ohio, and particularly in Central Ohio, and just convincing more of them to stay will go a long, long way. But the labor force participation is 68% or something like that, or 62%. I can't remember the exact number, but it's in the 60s, and it's not an Ohio specific problem, but that is a long term problem for your workforce.
And getting it here and keeping it here.
If we could just stop the exodus of people leaving Ohio, I think that would be the first step. And frankly, Columbus is doing its fair share because all the other places in Ohio are shrinking.
I just have about a half a minute left, Doug, but okay. I'm wondering to what extent or how what you'll be looking for in terms of how the benefits of Intel spread to the rest of the state that aren't going to be. I mean, do you see a larger state role in all of this?
I do. I look at it very similar to what Honda, did out in Marysville. I mean, they've got plants up in Northwest Ohio, far Western Ohio, that, Central Ohio. And, I think Intel, especially, I think you're going to see obviously the big concentration here, but there's a lot of land out there, a lot of sites that people can set up. And especially if Central Ohio starts getting too expensive, then they're going to look elsewhere.
Doug Buchanan, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Doug Buchanan is editor-in-chief at Columbus Business First. That's it for now. Thanks so much for joining us. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.